100 years. And one day Miss Shannon said she was going to find the knight and she'd be back in a few days and we had to stay here. The monsters would get us. She never came back.
Why would the Doughies want a school teacher? Moretti asked. Doesn't strike me as a key person for the entire colony.
Do you know anything about the bad men? Did Shannon ever say what happened to the city? Mom and Dad would talk about big adult things, Stephen said. Kept talking about Negev and the problem there?
What's Negev?
Carson asked.
Stephen pointed to the window. It's the red star,
Tony said.
No, Tony, not a star, a planet.
Stephen shook his head at his brother.
It just looks like a star.
Okay, but what happened to the city? All the people?
Carson asked.
Miss Shannon said it's one person's fault. A very bad man. She brought the monsters and took everyone away.
Stephen's hands balled into fists.
Who's that, Stephen?
Hale. Mr. Hale took our mom and dad away.
Chapter 6 Ken Hale stepped into his quarters on the Enduring Spirit and unfastened his collar. He dropped a data slate on a small desk and unzipped the top of his utility overalls halfway down his chest and let hours of sweat and stench billow out. 2 bedrooms, small living area, single bathroom, and kitchen unit in 350 square feet was lower-class living back in Phoenix, but the quarters were almost opulent by the rest of the ship standards. On a small round table was a foil-wrapped tray, one corner turned open and with steam wafting out. Hale looked at a clock on the wall and rubbed his face. How long had he been on his feet?
Boys, come on out, Hale said. I know you're up.
A bedroom door opened and 2 teenagers stuck their heads out. Jerry, the older, had his father's frame and looks. He had a faint stubble that drove Hale crazy, but his son wasn't in the service and had worked on that peach fuzz for several months. Elias took after his mother with thick black hair that seemed immune to brushing.
How'd you know?
Jerry asked.
We were in our cots and everything.
Reheat school off in minutes.
Hale pulled back a chair and sat down. He pulled off the foil of his meal, beef and black beans, and jabbed a fork into the mush.
Jerry ate the last ravioli,
Elias said.
I told him that's your favorite, but he said if he had to eat the tortellini again, he'd...
Really? Gonna narc on me about that?
Jerry slapped his brother on the shoulder.
Stop.
Hale took a bite.
So long as it's hot, I'm doing better most days during the war. It's not like you ate the last lemon pound cake.
He looked at Elias, who suddenly found his shoes very interesting.
How'd you know I was on my way back?
Mom came in for a shower and change, Jerry said. You two always swap out when things are going bad.
What'd she tell you?
Hale half got up to go for the fridge, but Elias waved him down and got a bottle of electrolyte-laden water and tossed it to his father.
Nothing.
Jerry said.
Which means it's real bad, huh, Dad? Don't play dumb.
Elias took a data slate from a pocket and swiped a finger over the screen. The log entries from the bridge scrolled up, all with Hale's crypto key stamped on them. Hale choked on his food and snatched the slate out of his son's hand.
How the hell did you get this?
Hale asked.
I may have cloned your security profile,
Elias said.
Don't be mad. I waited until we were through the gate to use it. No way Earth Security caught the hack. I learned my lesson.
The lesson was not to hack, not to keep from getting caught.
Hale rolled his eyes and slapped the slate against the desk.
Elias, you can't keep... Wait. You can't clone my security profile without a ton of biometric data.
You fell asleep on the couch last week.
Elias shrugged.
You don't wake up if I only open one eye at a time for your iris map.
He was at this for weeks, and you said nothing?
Hale narrowed his eyes as he spoke to Jerry.
What's he got on you?
Nothing now that we're never going back to Earth,
Jerry said nervously.
It wasn't anything bad. Not that bad.
Hale rubbed a temple, feeling a headache coming.
Sit, both of you,
Hale said. Chairs squeaked as they took spots around the table. There are 40,000 people on this mission that are counting on me for leadership and answers right now. You're part of that number. So help me help you, and don't add to the problem set. You understand?
I haven't shared that with anyone.
Elias pointed at the slate. The situation is developing, Hale said. I'm trying to get more information before I figure out a solution, Jerry. You're in the Junior Scouts. What did you learn about something like this?
Leaders develop the situation and act decisively. Commander's intent is always the first planning factor,
Jerry said, reciting from memory. And what are we doing here? Hale asked.
We're going to join the colony on Terra Nova, Jerry said.
But the colony's not there, is it?
The city's there, Hale said heavily. The people are not.
Uncle Jared's missing too.
Elias jerked a thumb at his brother.
I wanted to meet him. See if he's as bad as this, Jared.
I wanted to see my brother, Hale said. Been a lot of years, and now that I'm finally here, doesn't matter. We have a job to do. We're going to figure out what happened and make sure the planet is safe for everyone before we unload the colonists.
What about the Christophers?
Elias asked.
Why don't we go for the first wave ship before the city?
You don't have access to the ship's sensors, Hale said. Elias's face scrunched up in frustration. Hale took his own data slate out of a pocket, tapped the screen, and slid it across the table to his sons. An image of a mostly bare frame hung over Terra Nova's frozen moon. Elias zoomed in on a cluster of boxes on one spar.
Empty cargo, according to the sensors, Hale said. No bridge, no nothing. The ship was modular, meant to be used to build the colony soon as they arrived. The Enduring Spirit is built the same way. There's nothing to learn from the Christophorus.
Are we going home? Back to Earth?
Elias asked. Hale leaned back and crossed his legs.
We'd need a crucible gate, and years' worth of data before we would even know if that's possible,
Hale said.
Then we build the gate,
Jerry said. Hale's headache arrived. He never lied to his sons about the hidden aspects of his work in the Pathfinders or with this mission. When the conversation touched on something sensitive, Hale's go-to response was always, I can't say. His sons knew to stop asking about the subject. But now that they were in Terra Nova, the old rules had to change.
Elias, that information is top secret, Hale said.
Come on, Dad. It wasn't that hard to figure out.
Elias said.
Omnium reactors to build the gate thorns. Unnecessary graviton measurement equipment delivered under heavy guard. Off-the-grid data stacks and vaults? Why else would we need all of that, unless we were going to build our own crucible?
I told him about the servers,
Jerry said.
Heard about it from a tech at the gym.
Yes, we have the tech to make a crucible, Hale said. But we can't churn one out in a week and expect it to get us back to Earth. The gravity tides open the jump window every few years, if it would even work out here. It's all very experimental. Don't get your hopes up. Could you imagine being cooped up in these quarters for years?
You don't have to share a room with that one after one of his onion binge sessions,
Elias said.
They help with post-workout recovery, Point Dexter. You try lifting something heavier than a data slate sometime, and you wouldn't have pipe cleaners for arms,
Jerry said.
You learn some basic hygiene and—
We're not going back to Earth, Hale said. Get it out of your minds. We brought the crucible tech to get to the next star, expand the colony to another planet when the time was right. Have I ever quit a tough situation?
No,
the boy said. And why not?
Because you only fail when you quit,
Jerry said.
And Hales aren't quitters,
Elias finished. Hale's slate beeped. He looked at the incoming message and stood, refastening his utilities.
The Pathfinders are coming back from Terra Nova, Hale said. You two stay out of trouble. Love you both.
He left, without finishing his dinner. Despite having devoured two extra bars each on the flight back up to the Enduring Spirit, both boys sat in the ship's main conference room, shoving grilled chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy, and green beans into their mouths. Carson was slightly concerned they'd make themselves sick, but didn't have the heart to stop them from eating. After they'd showered and Moretti had managed to find them clothes that more or less fit, Nunez had promised to burn the filthy ones and jettison the ashes into space. The boy's hair hung in long, unmanaged strands that they had to constantly brush back out of their way.
"We need to set you boys up with haircuts soon,"
Carson told them just before the door opened and Director Hale strode into the room, obviously frustrated, his face stoic.
"All right, Chief. Let's hear it."
Carson nodded to Stephen.
"This is Stephen and his brother Tony, two brave little boys. Go ahead, Stephen. Tell my boss what you told me."
The boy looked away for a moment, then seemed to steel himself and repeated the story he'd told Carson back at the data center, stopping where Shannon had left them.
"We dug through the Christophorus' crew manifest during the return flight," Carson said. "There's no one by that name, or a knight. But they gave us her description and they identified this woman."
Carson handed the director a data slate displaying the picture of a woman in her early 40s.
"As Shannon. She was listed as Genevieve Delacroix," Carson added. "Education specialist."
"I know who this is,"
Hale said.
"She was an intelligence operative during the Ember War. Some of my Marines had a run-in with her on the Crucible. They were certain they saw her die, too."
"Earth sent spies on a colony mission?"
Carson asked.
"She didn't work for Earth. She worked for Ibarra."
Hale shook his head.
"A galaxy away and that bastard is still making my life difficult."
"Sir?"
Carson gently cleared her throat and leaned toward the director.
"There's a part to their story that I left off my initial report. Given the sensitive nature, I wanted to tell you in person and in private."
"Boys,"
Hale said, stepping past her.
"You are both very brave, and I'm glad you're here on the Enduring Spirit with us. We'll get you into your own quarters as soon as the doctors look you over."
Tony poked his brother on the shoulder.
"Can we have cocoa?"
Stephen asked between mouthfuls of mashed potatoes.
"All you can drink."
"Thank you, Mr....
Hale. My name is Hale."
The boy stopped chewing, dropping his fork to his plate with a clink. With a bestial cry, Stephen launched himself out of his chair and scrambled across the table, voice cracking as he yelled. He lashed out, bringing his fists down on Hale in a fury of attacks. Carson cursed, jumping to her feet as Hale shouted, backing away from the assault.
"Give me back my mommy and daddy!"
Carson managed to get her arms around the boy and pulled him away from the director.
"You took him away from us!"
the boy shouted, lashing out with his feet. Moretti stepped up and helped restrain Stephen.
"It's okay,"
Carson told him.
"It's okay, stop. It's not... Don't bite me! It's a different person named Hale!"
The boy refused to calm down until Hale stepped out of the conference room. Once Carson had him settled and assigned Moretti to keep an eye on the fuming child and to remain close by for support, she followed Hale into the corridor outside.
"I'm sorry, sir."
Hale dabbed a handkerchief to his lip and pulled it away. Blood seeped from a small cut, his bottom lip already starting to swell.
"What the hell was that?"
"That's what I was trying to tell you, sir. He seems to think Hale, not you, of course, is the one that's behind what happened to the colony."
"I just got cold-cocked by a scrawny little kid who looks like he hasn't had a decent meal in months. Maybe a little more heads up next time?"
"Sorry, sir, I didn't want to put that information out on the network until we could verify what he was saying."
Hale pulled the bloody handkerchief away from his mouth.
"Hale,"
he said.
"He must mean my brother Jared."
"No, not possible.
Jared would never do this.
He was a soldier, a leader. He came to Terra Nova to be an engineer."
"This doesn't make any sense to me."
"And you kept his name out of your report. Why?"
"Sir, I...
Carson stood at attention. The last time Hale had spoken this much to her was after her court-martial, and this conversation was going about as well.
"I thought if the crew heard your name in conjunction with the hostiles, it would create some confusion, erode your position in the chain of command."
"I can decide what does and does not affect my position and my crew, Chief Carson. Thank you very much. You don't have a record of pristine judgment, so the next time you think you have a better grasp on any situation than I do, think again."
He threw his bloody cloth into a garbage bin, then planted his hands on his hips. As he looked out of viewport to a red star in the distance, Carson caught his reflection. His mask of command had slipped, and she saw a man with the weight of the world on his shoulders, one dealing with unthinkable news about his brother. You have anything else to add about Jared? Hale asked.
All the boys know is the name, and that it's connected to Negev, she said. Negev is the fifth planet in the system just on the edge of the habitable zone. It's a dead rock, slightly warmer than Mars, incapable of supporting life. I think Shannon might have lied, told him something to give him hope.
I believe it. Hale sighed. But believing anything Ibarra or his operative say is always a bad idea. We've run probes across the entire planet and the moon. There's no sign of the colonists anywhere. The Christophorus is a shell, nothing to glean from there. Negev is our only lead for now.
How do we get there? Carson asked. Our ships are essentially barges. It would take them years to make the journey, and none of the mules have the range.
You've been on my ship for a total of what, 4 hours? Hale asked.
Closer to three, sir.
And you think you've seen everything? Report to Bay 9 with your team and get to work.
Hale double-tapped a screen on the back of his hand.
Marie, key leader and department head meeting in 10 minutes, no exceptions.
He walked off. Carson sucked in a breath to call after him, then reconsidered. She had a new task and was still in charge of her team after this interaction with Hale, which felt like an important step forward. She could only make things worse by asking more questions.
Meetings are the enemy of getting things done.
Hale thought to himself as he waited in the hallway outside the Spirit's main conference room. Calling a hastily emptied cargo bay a conference room was a bit of a stretch, but he wanted to address the mission's leaders at once. To do any less was to invite rumor and speculation, and if anything would foul up the workings of a large organization, it was the confusion and second-guessing that came from rumor and speculation. He heard his wife through the open door, doing her best to field questions while Hale prepped some difficult news for every ship and everyone in the fleet. Hale motioned to the guard at the door, and she signaled to Marie.
"The director,"
Marie said as Hale walked into the room. There was a groan of chairs as the department head stood up around a U-shaped table. Behind them was standing room only for their deputies and everyone else who'd been told to show up. The room stayed eerily silent, all eyes on Hale as he walked into the space between the conference table's parallel sections.
"Be seated," Hale said. "This day has not gone as planned. We made a successful wormhole jump. We are right where we're supposed to be, but Terra Nova is not as we expected. The Exo told you everything the Pathfinders learned?"
Marie nodded quickly.
"So you believe the children's story?"
asked Rajon Bosch, the mission's ranking medical doctor.
"I've seen their report on these hostiles from the Pathfinder team. Their basic structure is based on the Doughboy technology, without a doubt. How the hell did that happen?"
"At least one Ibarra operative has been identified as part of the first colony," Hale said. "That Ibarra chose to meddle with the mission should not come as any surprise to us."
"Why would Ibarra secretly send Doughboy pods with the colonists?"
"Mark Ibarra does things that only make sense to Mark Ibarra, and at this point why he sent them isn't as important as why they're so different now. They're based on the Mark III, sure, but other than that, their externality is strictly alien, something we've never seen before."
"But the Kaoresh said there wasn't supposed to be anyone else out here," one of the engineers said.
"And why did they take the colonists? Are they still alive?"
"Listen, people," Hale said, keeping his cool. "I don't have all the answers. Believe me, I wish I did. I know this isn't what you signed up for, but it's the hand we've been dealt, and unfortunately, we don't have any other choice. There is no retreat. No one is coming to help us. It's only us out here, and we have a situation to address."
Hale swiped his fingers down his forearm screen, and a holo of the six ships appeared in front of him.
"Our ships aren't meant for long-term occupation. We plan to disembark the families within the first hours of our arrival. Didn't take long for y'all to realize how uncomfortable the berthings were after everyone came aboard. We have emergency food stores for a few months. After that, we'd have to rely on what hydroponics can manage, and I've done the math. We'd have to jettison most of our equipment for food and nutrient tanks. Even then, we'd be on a severe calorie restriction."
Hale let that sink in.
"We have a number of options," Hale said. "We can try and found a new city on the main continent of Terra Nova." He tapped his forearm screen and the holos changed to a globe of the planet.
We don't have much weather or seismic data, but from what we can tell, the first colony set down at the best spot. Climate modeling shows the eastern coastline is prone to hurricanes. The north will be covered in snow 7 to 8 months out of the year, and the mountain ranges to the west are on par with the Rockies back on Earth and bone dry. The longer we wait to find a place for a city, the worse it will get for those of us still up here.
How much of a threat are those things the Pathfinders encountered in the city?
Asked George Handley, Hale's top void construction engineer and a decorated former strike marine.
Undetermined, Hale said. We haven't seen any more moving around the city since our team extracted.
No firearms? No obvious leadership?
Handley asked.
Doughboys without a handler, a little better than a pack of savages looking for something to break.
Another option is to retake the city, Hale said. Power, shelter, hydroponics, foundries, it's all there. While most every adult on this mission is a veteran, not all of you have been through combat. But as the situation unfolds, it's looking more and more like that may well be our only option. If we don't fight for our new home, no one else will.
Hale paused, looking over the faces of his staff. Some nodded, others shook their heads, but none offered objections. The respect Hale commanded, not only in this room, but in the entire fleet, was palpable.
We came to Terra Nova to build our home, and we're not going to let a bunch of feral doughboys keep us cowering in our ships. We need a militia, first to scout out just how strong the enemy force is, then to sweep and clear any and all hostiles. XO Hale has gone through our roster for commanders, but first, are there any volunteers?
Handley stood up, his meaty arms pressed against the table.
Sir, I've fought Zaro's drones, Toth warriors, and those damn Ruhold on more than one system. If you think I'm not going to take the opportunity to crack skulls for the sake of my family and the rest of you, I will be very disappointed, he said.
Any objections? Hale asked.
Good. See the XO and draw whoever you need for a recon company. We'll need to spin up the foundries and churn out weapons and armor for the troops.
Hale addressed the rest of the room.
We're all veterans here. Not every man and woman in the fleet is a former strike marine or ranger, but we know how to fight. We all came to Terra Nova prepared to do a job, but I'm going to call on you to do more than what you expected. Once the city is secure, we'll begin offloading specialist personnel and equipment and begin the process of ferrying the non-combatants down to the surface.
There's another option,
a small woman said from her seat at the end of the table. Anger stirred in Hale's heart, but he fought it back.
No, Ms. Tanner, there is not, Hale said.
The gag order was in effect only until we reached Terra Nova, she said. I doubt there are any spies in this room prepared to send a message back to Earth's enemies.
There are forces hostile to us in this system, Hale said.
Pish-posh, it's not like those doughboys can ever figure out the technology. They can barely do more than tie their boots and shoot a gun.
Tell everyone what's inside the old forge, Director. They all deserve to know.
Hale regretted the day he approved Tanner's application, no matter how useful she might prove in the future.
The old forge carries proto-material for a crucible gate, Hale said, and then waited for murmurs to die down. The tech used to create the gates is highly classified, and we had to keep its existence aboard the fleet secret. Earth agreed to give up the prototype for a small crucible gate with a limited range of a few dozen light years. It was to be the next step in our settlement of the Canis Major.
And we can have it functioning in a few months, Tanner said. It isn't difficult to find habitable planets with our sensors in other systems. Let's build the gate and be done with this place. No loss of life, no risk.
No risk?
Any data we collect from neighboring systems is years old.
What looks like a garden spot could have been hit by a comet a month ago, and we wouldn't know until we showed up, Hale said.
But the possibility remains that no.
Hale clasped his hands behind his back, an old habit from his days as commander of the Pathfinders, to signal when his mind was made up.
We're not going to cut and run on a hope when we have Terra Nova right beneath our feet. We're not leaving until we find out what happened to the first colonists.
What about our Pathfinders? Dr. Bosch asked. Isn't Rakan their sort of thing?
Our only lead is on Negev, Hale told him. They're prepping for the mission now.
And you're sure that your information is correct? Bosch asked, adding, I am considering the source.
A hint of emotion broke across Hale's face.
I believe the boy.
He has no reason to lie.
But, Director, Negev is halfway across the system. It will take the Spirit months to make that trip, not to mention the time it would take to offload all non-essentials and equipment. There were 10,000 people on the first mission. If we do find them all there, it won't be easy to get them all back here,
Bosch said. We need to find them before we can plan their return, Hale said. We're not sending the Spirit or any of our other ships. The Pathfinders will take our Sprinter ship.
The Sprinter?
Handley looked up from a data slate he shared with Marie.
It's not even assembled.
They're Pathfinders, Handley. They'll find a way, or make one. Chapter 7 Carson and Greer stood on a catwalk, looking down at a narrow spacecraft. On the deck, 20 meters below, construction cranes and robots worked the aft end, installing engines and applying hull plating. Sailors and Carson's Pathfinders worked the forward, mostly complete sections. The spacecraft was triple the size of a standard mule, with more cargo room, hardpoints, and crew capacity, while still maintaining the ability to make atmospheric entry. The problem was the ship wasn't fully assembled.
Some assembly required my ass, Carson said. We're damn near building the thing from scratch.
Well, considering we got it from the Mercury shipyards a day before we left Earth, Greer said, I'd say we're in pretty good shape. The Raven-class Sprinter is the latest in system transport. The prototype did the Mars Europa Titan circuit in just under 5 days.
That one was put together.
I don't see any of the Mercury engineers here to make sure this one works, Carson said.
Sparks flew from the frigate's extended port wing, where crews were busy attaching hull plating to the exposed skeleton frame. A team of engineers surrounded the rear of the ship, inspecting and running tests on its twin drives. Two teams of technicians were focused on the two sensor clusters at the nose and along the dorsal beam. Carson couldn't count the number of bots moving over and under the hull, adjusting sections of hull, welding, or carrying equipment to the work crews. Greer leaned forward, pressing her forearms against the catwalk's handrails.
Honestly, I didn't think I'd ever get to see one in action. Some other project kept bumping her production schedule back. Wasn't until Hale finally put his boot in their asses that the yard dogs pushed her off the line.
So when can we launch?
Greer blew out a long breath.
Propulsion system is good to go, but I'd like to give the navigation computers a little more time to chew on the data from Spirit's core. Tooling around in vacuum won't be an issue, but if you have to push her into Atmo, things get a little interesting. I'd like another week to get her airfoils and stabilizers up to spec.
Too long, Carson said, shaking her head. What about weapons?
The Ravens are shipped bare, so their units can customize them for specific mission requirements.
What's the payload?
She can carry a rover. According to the original mission brief, we're supposed to have one somewhere, but it's in storage.
I'm sure it'll need wrench time, too.
Probably.
So she's weak for a full Atmo drop. What about one equivalent to Mars? Could she handle that? I mean, without a miracle and a prayer?
As she's configured now, Greer pursed her lips and shrugged.
Take off and land, some light maneuvering.
The bots are welding on the support struts and hull plates, but those require an 18-hour fit test.
We'll do the checks on the way to Negev. Have the rover delivered. We'll assemble that on the way, too.
Greer chuckled. You Pathfinders are really something else. Carson gave her a sideways grin.
That's what they say.
Greer straightened. Well, if you want a miracle, I'd better get to work.
One more thing,
Carson said as the pilot turned to leave. Greer turned, eyebrows raised.
Does she have a name?
Just a serial number.
We'll have to fix that.
On the way. Nunez ducked as another round of sparks shot out from the panel above. On the other side of the panel, Moretti cursed, stepping back. He slapped the bulkhead and glared at Nunez. They were in one of the Sprinter ship's corridors, surrounded by a mess of cables, fiber optic lines, and crates of circuits. Shaking his head, Nunez leaned forward, inspecting the medic's work. One of the cables Moretti had been attempting to install lay draped over the panel's edge, the end jammed into what was clearly the wrong receptacle. A second, different-colored cable was jammed into a second receptacle adjacent to the first.
No, no,
Nunez said, pulling both cables free.
This one goes there, that one goes...
Wait. He held up the end of one cable, inspecting the metal cylinder at the end.
You're not even using the right capacitor. I told you, use the C-junction clamps. The G's can't handle the load. I thought you said you were good at repairing things.
Moretti crossed his arms.
If it's bleeding, I can fix it. Arteries, bone, muscle, I can understand those. This mess here doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Nunez pulled off the metal collars and moved to an equipment crate at the other side of the corridor.
You know, we're supposed to be having our Welcome to Terra Nova party right about now. Booze. Maybe some little paper umbrellas. Some colony chicks waiting to hear about the wonders of the galaxy and how yours truly conquered them all. Instead, it's mutant doughboys, missing colonists, and dangerous half-assed missions into the unknown. Catch?
Moretti caught the smaller clamp with both hands.
Not to mention the company.
You mean the chief? I'm actually starting to like her. I mean, she did save our asses down there. What's your beef with her anyway?
The medic sniffed, looking down at the cable as he twisted the clamp onto the end.
Let's call it a little bit of doubt.
He reached into the panel to attach the cable.
Doubt and...
The panel erupted in another shower of sparks, followed by a thin rail of smoke that curled out of the opening. Moretti jumped back, throwing the cable on the deck and letting out a string of angry curses. Nunez waved the smoke aside, coughing.
That's odd. Should have been a negative sump junction. Looks like we're going to need some fresh cable.
He pulled his head back and looked at the medic. Moretti's face was red with anger.
I get it, Nunez said. Why don't you take five?
Outside the frigate, Popoff sat on one of the many empty storage crates littering the deck of Spirit's main bay, watching Birch maneuver his powered lifter suit into position. The exoskeleton of the PLS wrapped around Birch's body, effectively adding another 4 feet to his height. The top section of the suit was removable for work in pressurized and non-pressurized environments, and Birch had elected to leave it open. The entire suit, including the large mechanical grippers and thick, powerful legs, were controlled by the sergeant's body movements. He reached forward and the suit's grippers clamped down onto the twin-barreled external weapons turret.
You really think it'll work?
Birch looked down from the suit and shrugged.
Both the mule turret system and the Raven's external hardpoints are designed to be modular. Now, whether or not this old Gauss system will communicate with the Raven's advanced software, I guess we'll find out soon enough. Did you find the code patch yet?
I've found a driver that's 3 generations out of date,
Popoff said. Need to recode it by hand. Birch lifted the turret from its container, then turned and moved across the deck, raising the weapon system over his head. One of his gremlins zipped past the turret to orbit the recess on the Raven's hull that the weapon would, in theory, slide into. Carefully, Birch lowered the turret into place, leaning out to look around the turret as he neared the hull. The drone began welding several connections from the underside of the turret to the Raven's external feeds. A minute later, the turret slid smoothly into its recessed cradle, and the drone set about activating a series of retention clamps around the base.
Nicely done, Sarge, Popoff said as Birch stepped back from the hull.
One of the great things about military hardware. Most of the time, they're plug and play.
The gremlin floated level with Birch's face, lights flashing as it chirped. Birch appeared to listen as the drone sounded off, then waved his hand toward the frigate.
Then apply the pneumatic ring bypass. The protocol should be in the Spirit servers.
The drone chirped, and tiny lights near the lenses seemed to wink at the man before it floated off to hover about the turret once again. Popoff raised an eyebrow. Problems?
He thinks there could be a risk of some harmonic dissonances caused by firing the turret that could disrupt the Raven system when it fires.
So we shoot that thing and we could lose life support.
We shoot the thing and the wing shears off, or several other less catastrophic possibilities. Engineers don't like to slap a gun on a way of thinking, not since the First World War, where pilots blew off their own propellers before someone invented an interrupter gear. Then again, if it comes down to needing to shoot something or take a hit, I'd rather run the risk of a few minor system hiccups over not being able to defend ourselves out there.
Sergeant West came around the side of the frigate, catching Popoff's attention.
He locked eyes with her, giving her the classic NCO shouldn't-you-be-doing-something stare. Popoff hopped off the crate, picked up a wrench from the deck, and moved toward the Raven.
"Your drone is pretty responsive," Popoff said to Birch.
"I've made a few modifications to him over the years,"
Birch said, powering down the lifter.
"I've almost got all the kinks worked out, but he can still be a little..."
The drone stopped working, spun almost as if it was looking at Birch, and gave him a long, high-pitched beep.
"Temperamental?"
Popoff grinned.
"I see that."
"He's one of a kind. For now."
Birch pushed the suit's safety bar over his head and the panels over his waist and legs folded open. He jumped out, and the dog tags inside his shirt popped out of his collar. Pathfinders always wore two, one to remain on those that fall in battle, the other to be carried by the slain's commander and the loss recorded. On Birch's chain was a thick cluster of tags wrapped in black tape, two silver ones and a gunmetal Templar cross. Birch pressed the cross to his lips before he stuffed it all back down his shirt. Popoff stopped her coding, her mind trying to register why Birch would have so many dog tags. His old team. Birch had lost all five members of his team to an ambush, then gone on to recover the wounded armor soldier and complete the team's original mission. He still carried their tags.
"I am the greenest pathfinder in the entire corps, and look who I'm talking to," she thought.
"They aren't easy to acquire in the first place, not to mention the amount of work that goes into upgrading them. Took me almost 2 years to get them to where they could work a mission without almost complete autonomy. But I've got spare parts to make more, and I can clone their operating systems and decision protocols easy enough."
"Thought the Corps wasn't big on equipment alteration."
"They're not," Birch grunted. "But all the team leaders I've served with usually tend to give me a lot of leeway in how I do things."
"Because of your medal?"
"Because I get results."
"Seems like everyone on this mission has done something notable but me. Carson hasn't spoken to me since we came back aboard. Kinda makes me wonder..."
She trailed off. Birch raised an eyebrow.
"What?"
"You know, if she's having second thoughts about their team's roster. I've heard of team leaders completely scrapping their rosters and bringing in people they want."
"Despite the considerable lack of pathfinders to choose from out here, I don't think you have anything to worry about."
"It's just... I'm not used to this. I saw that body down there and I just froze. I'm not like you or West. Both of you. Hell, the rest of the team have seen plenty of action. I thought I was ready for it."
Popoff scoffed, shaking her head.
"And I blew chunks on my very first engagement."
"And you think no one else on the team lost their lunch the first time they came under enemy fire? That we all just ran into battle, steel veterans. We've all been there. In fact, I'd have been worried if you weren't nervous. It would have meant you didn't understand the situation."
Popoff laughed.
"The fact of the matter is you stayed with the team and you never gave up. You didn't crack or fold under pressure. I've seen men and women, some of the best fighters the Corps ever produced, crumble as soon as the fight started to deteriorate. From what I've seen, I'm not worried about you. Staying in the fight just like you did makes all the difference."
"Maybe,"
Popoff said, looking down at the wrench as she turned it over in her hands.
"But I'm not like you. I know what you did on Fredericksburg, dragging that armor soldier 3 miles out of hostile territory while under constant fire, then holding them off until they could evac both of you. I don't think I could do that alone."
"I wasn't alone."
Birch touched his heart.
"St. Colin was with me the entire time."
He then produced a tablet from a cargo pocket and started tapping commands. A soft hum filled the air around them as the turret came online. The twin-barrel cannons lifted up and the turret spun clockwise, then back counterclockwise. As it completed its second revolution, the entire thing jittered, followed by several mechanical clunks from inside the turret. Sparks shot out from a panel along its base, and smoke curled into the air. Popoff stepped back, craning her head up to see.
Is it supposed to do that?
4 hours. 4 long, expletive-filled hours later, Carson and West stood in the Sprinter's small bridge behind the two pilots. Dirt and sweat covered all 4, and Carson knew the entire crew was in desperate need of some rack time. She was proud of her team. Only Pathfinders could handle going from a botched mission to hours on end of complex engineering work. The Enduring Spirit's large cargo bay doors loomed ahead, orange safety strobes flashing at the corners. The deck had been cleared of all non-essential personnel and equipment, and the crew of Raven 6C974 had completed all their pre-flight checklists.
Okay.
Lieutenant Oscar Lincoln, Greer's new co-pilot, adjusted his helmet.
I think we're ready.
Signal Spirit,
Greer said. The pilot tapped a screen.
Spirit Control, Raven 6, Charlie 974, pre-flight complete, standing by to depart.
A second later, Director Hale's face appeared on the screen.
Raven 6, Charlie 974, all systems green?
Lincoln coughed.
Status board looks like a Christmas tree, sir, but all critical systems are green.
I understand. If we had time for more shakedown, I'd gladly give it to you, but we don't. I want you gone before we clear the planet's horizon and before we're in line of sight with Negev. If there are any prying eyes over there, I don't want them to see your launch. Chief Carson?
Yes, sir.
Your mission is recon. In and out. We're not looking to announce ourselves before we have to. Find some sign that the colonists are out there and alive and report back. I need information, not heroes.
Understood?
Received and understood, sir.
Good. Godspeed. Hale out.
The connection terminated before Carson could respond, and Hale's image vanished from the screen. An alarm sounded, and the orange safety strobes changed to red as the large bay doors began to open. Terra Nova hung in the void outside.
It looks so much like Earth,
Carson thought, craning her neck to get a better view. A metallic clunking echoed through the frigate's hull as the docking clamps unlocked and detached. The ship dropped slightly as the onboard engines engaged and sputtered slightly.
Add that to the list?
Lincoln asked. Carson and West exchanged apprehensive glances.
Problem?
Carson asked.
Not if we want to get out of a gravity well stronger than Earth's, Greer said.
We can repair it on the way. Leaving it at that, the pilot tapped on his screen and pushed the throttle forward. The constant thrumming from the drives pitched up slightly as the frigate accelerated, and 5 seconds later they cleared the bay doors and entered the void.
We'll be on boosters for a bit,
Lincoln said, turning them away from the planet below.
We'll hit a slingshot around the moon, then ride the momentum until we kick on the anti-grav drives for the rest of the trip. Should minimize our detection signature.
How long are we looking at?
Carson asked.
About 29 hours, give or take.
Carson shot West another sidelong look.
Give or take what?
Greer twisted in her seat to look back at the chief.
Hey, I can give you the entire list of things that can go wrong on this flight, or you can leave it to the professionals and enjoy the trip in blissful ignorance.
West laughed.
I chose ignorance.
He turned and stepped through the hatch at the rear of the compartment. Carson put a hand on the pilot's seat back.
Just give me a heads up if we come up on something major, would you?
I'll have a prioritized list of repairs and adjustments to make in 2 hours,
Greer said.
Guess you all can slack off while we make sure the shakedown cruise doesn't turn into a shake-apart-and-die cautionary tale.
Carson bit back a retort, turned, and left the pilots to their work. She stepped through the hatch onto a small platform, then made her way down a short flight of stairs to the open cargo bay. Most of her team had formed up around the rover, which sat in several pieces in the middle of the bay. Birch sat on the deck, his back pressed against the largest cargo crate, chin resting against his chest. Nunez and Popoff had spread out several feet away, both curled around their gear bags. Moretti had pushed 2 smaller crates together into a makeshift bed and lay with his hands clasped over his chest. West turned as Carson approached and nodded.
There, a tracer burnout. If we don't get any rest, we'll make stupid mistakes when we assemble the rest of the rover. Shouldn't take more than 5 or 6 hours to get the rover together. We'll have plenty of time for that before we reach Negev.
Carson stretched.
I feel like I could sleep for hours. What about you?
Don't need it. I fuel up on anger, caffeine, and the souls of inattentive junior enlisted soldiers. Chief of this boat is a bit saltier than me.
This bucket'll be flying just fine by the time we get to our destination.
The pain in her leg flared again, and Carson sat back against the stairs railing, rubbing it.
What do you think we'll find out there?
Your guess is as good as mine. I'm just hoping we find some survivors and learn something that'll give us a fighting chance against whoever took them. By the looks of things, the original colonists got caught with their pants down. At least I'm hoping that's the case, and that the enemy isn't something like the Zaros.
You and me both.
But if there's anyone alive that can figure out some way to win this, it's Hale.
Carson laughed.
The great and powerful Ken Hale, hero of the Breitenfeld, star of the last stand on Tekkini, galactic negotiator, who doesn't have a...
She trailed off, finishing the thought in her head.
Who doesn't have an ounce of faith in me.
You think he doesn't trust you?
I didn't say that.
What happened on the Belisarius wasn't your fault.
Carson looked back at her team sergeant.
Some would disagree.
You were clear. Everyone else can have their opinion. I side with those who did the investigation and weighed all the evidence.
Being found not guilty carries an asterisk when your first contact mission ends in a bloodbath and an entire world being quarantined, she said.
I've read the whole report, Chief, not just what the media wanted to release. In your position, I wouldn't have done anything differently. Were there some casualties? Sure. But there are way more people alive because of what you did. You objected to Captain Gavin bringing those aliens aboard. What happened is on him.
Gavin's dead, Carson said. And I should have disobeyed that order. Maybe the Quan Chi would have made a different decision if they didn't have a starship right for the taking.
Carson took a long breath and let it out.
Well, for what it's worth, thanks. Unfortunately, there are plenty of people that don't share your sentiments.
The Corps is a small organization. What happens to one happens to us all. I'm sure there isn't anyone with their wings that wasn't affected in some way because of what happened. But I'm with you, Chief.
I appreciate that.
Now you should get some rest. I have a feeling there won't be much opportunity for it once we get where we're going.
You're probably right.
Carson stretched again, then nodded to the collection of cargo containers.
I just hope that rover isn't in too many tiny pieces. I'm about done assembling things.
West laughed.
I couldn't agree more.
Birch hefted a wheel onto the rover's front axle and held it in place while his gremlin screwed down the nuts. The drone chirped and flew up.
You said that the last time,
Birch said as he grabbed the handle on the jack beneath the wheel well and pulled it free. The rover thumped against the deck, pneumatic shocks hissing. The rest of the team and several of the sprinter's naval crew had gathered near the front of the rover. Carson spoke with West and the ship's chief petty officer. As she spoke, Nunez moved through the crowd holding a small sack, collecting small strips of paper from those assembled. Carson nodded to the petty officer. He turned around and shouted,
Company, attention!
Chatter stopped as the pathfinders and sailors snapped their heels together.
At ease, Carson walked along the front rank. I've been around the Navy long enough to know that being on a ship that hasn't been properly christened is bad luck.
The Navy personnel gathered nodded their agreement. Nunez held the bag in front of Popoff, and she dropped dozens of slips of paper into it. Nunez then hurried over to Carson, handed her the bag, and fell in at the back of the formation.
So,
Carson said as she shook the bag,
I've asked all of you to submit some names for consideration, and hopefully we've got a winner in here.
The crowd chuckled as one of the Navy ratings slapped another on the shoulder. Popoff looked over and saw Nunez grinning, whispering something to Moretti. Carson finished shaking the bag and pulled out the first slip of paper.
The confidence!
One or two murmured acceptance, but the rest seemed indifferent. Carson shrugged, dropped the slip to the floor, and pulled out a new one.
The aluminum falchion?
Carson said, her brow furrowed in confusion. She mouthed the name again and tossed the paper aside. In the ranks of the assembled crew, someone failed to smother a giggle.
The Schwantz!
Carson frowned and read it again.
What's the Schwantz?
Several shrugged. The chief tossed the paper aside.
Oh, come on! She held up the next slip. The Richard Head?
The shoulders of one sailor heaved up and down in silent laughter.
Spacey McSpaceface? Holy okay, who did this?
Carson gave Popoff a dirty look, and the junior Pathfinder opened her mouth to protest, but a grunt from West kept her quiet. Nunez, in the back rank, had a poker face.
Sparkle motion?
Carson tossed a slip over her shoulder and pawed through the bag.
I don't even know what Modak means.
Popoff gasped, hand over her mouth. In the back rank, a sailor buried his face in his hands, smothering his laughter. Carson looked right at Popoff and read,
The hey would you blow me?
Sergeant West stepped out of the group.
All right, people, lock it up!
It took a few seconds for the laughter to subside. When it did, West turned to Carson, jaws set, eyes hard.
Sorry about that, Chief.
So this how it's gonna be?
Carson asked, holding up the bag.
Jokes? We've got jokes. This is why we can't have nice things around here.
Fine. The next name I pull out is the name we're going with.
You guys want to explore the star system in the fart knocker or something? Be my guest. No more discussion.
She pulled the paper out, cleared her throat, and looked over the slip, then dropped the paper without reading it aloud. Her face red. Finally, Carson pulled another slip of paper from the bag, read it, and sighed.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard the Valiant.
The crowd cheered.
Petty Officer Torgerson, Sergeant West,
Carson said, tossing the bag aside.
A word, please.
A silence fell over the crew, but they remained in formation. Moretti leaned close to Popoff.
Way to go, idiot.
Popoff held up both hands to her side.
No, I picked ship names from Russian history.
Nunez hissed from the rear rank to her.
We'll be spit shining every last inch of this bucket for the next year. I saw what you did.
I didn't.
All right,
Torgerson shouted, walking back to the formation.
You jokers want to play games? We're going to play a little game I like to call squat thrust until you puke.
Everyone in the formation let out a groan. Torgerson grinned.
Oh, you've heard of it before. Good. I won't have to explain the rules then. Everyone get some spacing. Three count exercise. Sound off like you mean it. Ready. Exercise.
Carson and West stepped through the hatch and into the Valiant's cockpit, stopping behind the two pilots. Ahead, the reddish-brown planet hung in the void against a background of alien stars. Small white areas marked the polar caps. Large swaths of dark brown and black marked several mountain ranges stretching across the surface.
Could be Mars, Carson said.
It's not that far off, Lincoln said, tapping his screen. Sensors say it's only slightly larger than Mars, with 60% Earth gravity. Most of the atmo's been stripped away and there's no magnetic field to speak of.
Definitely not a prime honeymoon spot, Carson said.
Don't see any major geological features like Mars's Olympus or Valles Marineris, Greer said, which you'd expect on a world that sputtered out on the way to being habitable like Terra Nova.
It's a lot of ground to cover, West said.
The pilot held up a finger.
That's why I called you up here, Sergeant.
Lincoln tapped on his screen again and a grainy image appeared. The image was slightly out of focus, but Carson could definitely make out the sharp lines and angles of a human-designed spaceship.
That's an ore miner, West said. I worked for the Ibarra Company in the asteroid belt before the war. Recognize that thing anywhere. Good for ripping apart rocks for the good parts and slow hauls across the system. Not much else.
Steven said there was a rock ship over the city when the corrupted doughboys attacked, Carson said. Guess this is why they weren't there to greet us when we showed up.
I concur, Chief, West said.
Carson felt her chest tighten as the view changed. A long trench scarred the landscape where the ship had plowed through the soil during an apparent crash landing. Debris littered not only the trench, but the surrounding area around the ship as well. The image changed again and West cursed.
Is that?
Carson trailed off, knowing the answer before she finished the question. Near the bow, one of the exterior hatches had been blown open, leaving a large gaping hole in the hull. Among the debris extending out from the hole, Carson counted 3 bodies. She couldn't tell if they were doughboys or human.
Those ships weren't designed to haul passengers, West said. At least not in the numbers we're talking about, not without extensive modifications to the life support systems.
They wouldn't have been able to fit all the colonists aboard that thing even with mods,
Carson said. West rubbed his chin.
The Christophorus was more of a modular conglomerate of ships inside a single frame, modular just like the Spirit. This ship must have been part of the Christophorus. There were several of these ships built onto the support structure of the vessel.
How many?
At a guess, maybe 2 or 3.
Then where are the rest? There's nothing left of the Chris but a frame and some empty cargo pods?
Carson turned to Greer.
How much of the surface area have you been able to scan?
Not much. The radar return on that ore ship was the first thing we picked up. You want a full scan, it'll take another day.
Carson played over her options in her head. She didn't have many, and she didn't like the ones she had. Ideally, she'd spend a week surveying the surface of the planet, but they didn't have that kind of time.
Would the Valiant hold up for a surface landing?
As long as no one starts shooting at us, we should be fine.
Okay. Set us down here.
Carson leaned forward and tapped the pilot screen.
We can take the rover the rest of the way in.
She turned to West.
Thoughts?
The Master Sergeant pursed his lips, considering the map. After several seconds, he tapped a different part of the map.
If we land here, we'll have a better line of sight to the crash site, and should be able to get at least within small arms range before anyone will be able to see us.
Carson looked over the approach and nodded.
Good. Okay, Greer, set us down there. Then return to a low orbit. Just stay close enough to provide close air support and evac if we need it. We'll come back up and keep looking if that ship's a dry hole.
Roger that, Chief.
Chapter 8. If mules were a tight fit, the rover was downright claustrophobic. Carson sat in the passenger seat next to Birch, who sat behind the controls, running last-minute checks on the vehicle's systems. She looked back over her shoulder at the rest of her team, all strapped into seats on either side of the rover's cargo bay.
Sergeant West, how we looking?
West flashed her a thumbs up.
All personnel locked and loaded, Chief.
Carson clicked her IR over to the Valiant's channel.
Open her up, Greer.
Through the rover's windshield, they watched as the Valiant's rear cargo ramp folded open, revealing the dull, rust-colored landscape of Negev. Wind howled against the all-terrain attack vehicle, rocking it slightly.
25 meters, Lincoln reported.
20.
The Valiant kicked up a whirlwind of dust and dirt as it neared the surface, temporarily obscuring the Pathfinder's view. Carson was more than a little apprehensive about trusting their departure to someone she barely knew, but she knew there wasn't any other way.
10.
Birch pulled the release on the rover's parking brake.
Hold on to your butts. 5, 4, 3, 2, clear.
At the signal, Birch slammed the throttle forward and Carson's stomach turned at the abrupt drop as the rover raced off the ramp and dropped to the surface. They landed with a jolt, and despite preparing herself, the impact jarred Carson around in her seat, her helmet knocking off the bulkhead. Birch turned the wheel and they drove out of the dust cloud left behind by the Valiant. They continued to turn until they saw the Sprinter rising back into the air, its ramp already closing.
Rover one down,
Carson said.
Roger that, Chief,
Greer answered. Good hunting. Call me if you need anything. From the back, Nunez mumbled,
Just once, I want to sit down like a normal person. Do the shuffle through security. Stand in line at some old spaceport. Pay too much for a cup of coffee. And pick up my luggage.
Lock it up, Nunez,
West shouted. Carson tapped on the small display mounted in front of her seat.
Keep an eye on the road, Birch. Looks like we'll be able to piggyback off the Valiant sensors for now, but there's no way to tell how long the connection will last.
West appeared in the hatch between them. He held onto a piece of frame above him, holding himself steady against the rover's rocking.
Nice work, Birch.
Easier than Phoenix traffic,
the driver said.
We've got about 50 clicks to go before we hit that spur,
Carson said. Let's stay frosty, Sergeant.
Roger that, Chief.
As they rolled across the barren landscape, the team unbuckled and moved around the tight space, readying their gear. After their engagement in the colony, Carson had the team in full combat kit. They drew carbines from the armory with integrated grenade launchers and all carried a variety of explosives. Hale had sent her down on a recon mission, but she'd rather have the firepower and not need it than need it